Moncrief on News Talk.
The Bram Stoker Festival kicks off this Friday, and as luck would have it, a previously unknown story by Stoker was discovered in Dublin. Gibbet Hill was found in the 1890 Christmas supplement of the Dublin Daily Express. The man who discovered it is the writer and Stoker enthusiast Brian Cleary. Afternoon, Brian.
Hi, Sean.
We'll get to why you had so much time to be researching it, but tell us about the story first.
Yeah, the story, it's called Gibbet Hill. It's a short story. It's about 25 pages in the book. Stoker wrote it around the time he was writing Dracula. So he started writing Dracula in March 1890. He went to Whitby on his holidays in August 1890 and he found the name Dracula in a book there in the library. And he wrote it down multiple times in his Dracula notes because he liked the sound of it on his tongue. Mm. And in October 1890, then he visited Lord Tennyson in Surrey, just outside London, with his boss, Henry Irving, who was a very famous actor at the time. And he wrote this story based on that trip. He came across the Sailor's Stone, which memorialises a sailor murdered by three thieves. Those three thieves were strung up on Gibbet Hill, on a gibbet, and their bodies were left there for 3 or 4 years as a warning to other thieves.
So that's why it was called Gibbet Hill.
Yeah, yeah. They eventually came down in a storm, but yeah. Obviously local lore figured out that this place was haunted, and the stone itself is rumoured to be haunted.
Yeah. And as I mentioned there, it did appear in the kind of Dublin edition of the Daily Express. Was it written specifically for that, do you know?
Or? Yeah, he was probably commissioned. So his Trinity College mentor, Edward Dowden, was the next story beside him. So he probably was asked by Dowden, or, you know, I think he had links as well to the newspaper owners. And he would have written for the Dublin Press when he was in college. And when he worked in Dublin Castle, he did free theatre reviews and kind of started out his theatre life through that. That's how he met Henry Irving. That's how he moved to London. That's how he moved in very famous circles over in London.
Mm. And and why has the story remained unknown? Because it seems like it's not in, you know, the lists of his work.
I searched high and low, and I talked to Paul Murray, who's the best of the Stoker biographers. His biography is just spectacular, and he knows, he's an encyclopedic knowledge of Stoker. And Paul was as flabbergasted as I was that it had been lost. And here we were, potentially some of the first people to read it in 134 years.
Yeah, and in the way that for writers you can see, especially if you're very familiar with their work, as you know you would be, that you can see those little connections, how perhaps one thing led to the other.
You totally see the genesis of Dracula in it. So it's a really important time when he's coming up with the plot of Dracula, and his notes for Dracula are in Philadelphia in a museum, and you can get them online. And it's spectacular to see how it develops. But there are themes, there are specific lines, there's motifs and imagery that are common to both Gibbet Hill and Dracula. So I think it's a really important literary find. Stoker scholars are going to have a great time with it and will be able to see how he developed as a writer and how he was gathering stuff all the time. You know, he was building up this story from when he was a small child, when he was sick in bed out in North Dublin suburbs. He didn't walk till he was 7, apparently. So his mother would have been telling him bedtime stories about the 1832 cholera epidemic and her experience as a teenager. And it's just a fascinating time. Like I'm a writer. I've been doing stuff behind the scenes and not telling anyone about it. And this was all part of world building and, you know, getting into the nitty gritty of those time periods, like 18th and 19th century Ireland and Europe are just fascinating. And there's incredible stories to be told with that material in historical fiction.
Yeah.
So Charlotte had a very interesting experience. Oscar Wilde's father, you know, experienced that same cholera epidemic. And I just find it fascinating. You know, I'd spend a lot of hours in a library looking at this stuff.
Yeah.
Very sadly.
And in terms of his development as a writer, you know, are there flaws in Gibbet Hill that you don't see in Dracula, or perhaps, you know, stylistic mistakes?
Yeah, he's repeating himself a little bit in it. Mm. There's tropes that he uses all the time. There's a honeymoon couple in it. You know, he always has honeymoon couples in those early stories. I found multiple short stories as I went through the process. I was systematically searching in the British newspaper archives. I was looking specifically for everything I could find about Stoker, including the ads. And that's where I got lucky. I found the ad for this story. There was a supplement to the Christmas edition. It was being advertised on New Year's Day. They obviously had spare copies and they were trying to flog it off. So that kind of attention to detail found the story. But there's amazing. This is an amazing story. There are less amazing stories out there of his to be found.
Yes.
I found them, and they had some elements of Dracula in them. They had a character from Whitby. They had a mention of maimed burial rites, which is essentially stake through the heart stuff.
Mm.
So you can see he's working his way up gradually towards what ultimately became a literary classic.
And yeah.
Type Dracula into your phone, you're going to get an emoji. You know, yeah. No other literary character.
Yes. Yeah,
that gets that treatment.
I often worry. I wonder about that when they do that to writers. They do it to musicians as well. That stuff that they never chose to release, that other people go and find it and say, you know, but that like that's the crap stuff they didn't want you to see.
Bram wanted to release this, so the notes for the there was a posthumous release of short stories, including Dracula's Guest, which was a pre-chapter of Dracula that was cut. So Florence Stoker released them. Bram's wife, she said in her introduction that he'd planned on releasing three collections of short stories before he died. So she released that one, but there were no other collections. So I think he had a file somewhere that was a list of all of his short stories. And, you know, he had intended on doing this, but never got to it.
Okay. Well, then we can be happy and respect his wishes in that respect. Now, as you said, you were kind of researching your own work. But you did suddenly, unexpectedly, have a bit of free time in your hands in that, was it Christmas of 2021?
Yeah, yeah.
You had sudden hearing loss.
Yeah, I woke up with no hearing on my left side. So it was quite a shock. You know, you quickly lose your ability to communicate easily in lots of different environments. So if there's any background noise or if someone isn't speaking clearly, you're not going to hear them. So you're going to miss the joke. You know, you're going to, you know, eventually get isolated. When you lose hearing suddenly like that, your brain makes up, you know, a replacement. So you end up with very severe tinnitus.
Mm.
So mine was assessed as part of an audiology assessment, and it was 85 decibels. So that's kind of...
Oh, my God.
Hold the hairdryer at arm's length and just carry around with you all day, you know. So it was tough. It's possible to cope with it. It's possible to get by. But I pursued a cochlear implant because I'm a researcher. You know, I looked at the papers on cochlear implants. They're effective for people with single-sided deafness. Unfortunately, not accessible through the Irish health system, through the cochlear implant unit in Beaumont, because obviously they're just funded for people who are completely deaf and for children who get bilateral cochlear implants. But if I was in Germany or if I was in other EU countries, I would get it through the public health system. So thankfully, the HSE approved me to go through the treatment abroad scheme, and I drove to Berlin because you can't fly after they punch a hole in your...
Okay, understand.
Inner ear, yes. In the middle of your head. So I was very lucky, and it worked really well for me.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful.
The procedure, is it very involved, or is it kind of a...
It's involved, yeah. So they cut a hole in your head, and they drill into your skull, and then they thread a very fine wire into your inner ear. You've got this tiny little snail shape right in behind your eye, essentially. They get the little electrode into that inner ear, and that electrode, there's 22 electrodes on mine, that takes the sound input from the microphones on the device on my ear.
Mm-hmm.
The sound input travels along a wire into this round coil, and then it goes across the skin into another coil on the inside, down the wire, stimulates my cochlear nerve, and my brain interprets that as, this is sound, you know?
Okay, and so, the difference between what you're hearing through your right ear and what you're hearing through your cochlear implant ear.
Nice high fidelity audio system on my right and a 1950s, you know, lo-fi AM radio on my left. But they add up, my brain actually adds them up into a really good sonic signal that's much louder than my right ear alone and gives me much better word understanding in lots of different environments. But the tinnitus being gone is the main... One of the main benefits.
Well, I mean, imagine the tinnitus, like that level of tinnitus, you mustn't have been able to sleep or
There's people worse. I could sleep, you know, if I went out to a restaurant, you had a certain amount of noise dollars you could spend in the day. So you got to go to work, you got to get exposed to noise. You come home and your head is banging because, you know, the tinnitus is very loud. So you bit of rest, then you put a little bit more in the account, and then there's knives clattering and there's dishwasher and, you know, the children and all that. And that adds to it again. And at the end of the day, it's really loud, but then it resets overnight. So I was able to get to sleep at night, but some nights if I went out or, you know, I chose to go to a concert with, you know, earplugs in, I'd get home and I'd have like 2 or 3 hours worth of tinnitus to look forward to.
Yeah.
So I would have walked to Berlin for the CI surgery, to be honest with you.
And when it first...
I would have crawled pushing a pee with my nose. Yeah.
When it first happened, did you kind of wake up and think, oh, maybe I've got a blockage in my ear or something, you know, the explanation was something more mundane?
I went straight away. I was worried about it because I was thinking about my job. Like, I need to hear in complex environments and pick up important information. And I was worried about that on day one because I put the phone up to my ear and I couldn't hear it. So about 1,000 people in Ireland get it every year. Not everyone gets it as bad as me. Some of those recover spontaneously. But unfortunately, there's poor awareness among the general public. There's poor awareness among health professionals about sudden sensorineural hearing loss, which is the medical term for it. But the key message for the listeners is if someone suddenly loses their hearing, there's a sudden serious change in their hearing, straight to hospital, straight to an ENT specialist. You need steroids. And if you get them within 24 hours, you might save your hearing. If you don't, you possibly won't.
What causes it? Is it known?
Unknown in 90% of the cases. So, you know, in my situation, no explanation. I had all the tests. So there might be some underlying genetic cause. Maybe in the future we'll find it out. I want to find out for my children's sake.
Yeah.
But at the moment, unexplained.
That's astonishing. Congratulations, though, at the same time, Brian. Fantastic bit of detective work. And is your own writing ongoing now? Is it that project?
It is. Now I'm going to have everyone asking, where's the book? So yeah. I brought that myself. So we're an indie publisher. Essentially, the Rotunda Foundation publishes this beautiful book. We've got artwork from Paul McKinley in the book, which is just beautiful. And he's donated prints to the foundation. So all of this is going to go into a Charlotte Stoker fund. That fund is going to be used for research on potentially preventable deafness. Like, if this happened to me when I was 17, I wouldn't have gotten through the Leaving Cert. I would have had a very different life. So, you know, thinking about acquired hearing loss in younger people and ways to potentially prevent it, because I can see, I'm a pharmacist, I work in the Rotunda, I can see how with evolving knowledge on risk factors for hearing loss and how they interact, you know, there are potentially ways to prevent it. So,
And
RotundaFoundation.ie has the sales link, pre-sales link.
Okay, say that again.
RotundaFoundation.ie.
RotundaFoundation.ie. Brian, thanks a million for coming in to us today. That was Brian Cleary there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.